Where is your mind while you're at work? Do you ever feel like you're just getting by or barely managing to hold on and hold it together? I'm Ilana Afrika Bredenkamp. Welcome to Mind at Work. In this series, we explore the mental hurdles we face in the workplace and how understanding our minds can lead to real, lasting solutions.
I needed someone famous for our Mind at Work podcast, so I don't know many people, John.
Sorry, you didn't get anyone famous. Sorry about that.
Why are you not famous anymore? Why did you resign comedy? I see these things on social media and I'm like, I'm just going to ask John to his face. Say it to my face.
I don't know what you've seen on social media. I'm not there much, but I'm just choosing evolution and stillness in a way, and clarity and health. So I'm happier.
So you've gone from comedy to common sense. I just made that up.
I know what I just made up. Yeah, I don't like the phrase common sense. I like uncommon sense because I think we are dangerously flirting with misconception and with wrong views as the norm. And that's part of it. You know, part of it is you can come to a show, I can pick the lowest hanging fruit because that's the quickest way to make you laugh. We can all bond over stereotypes. We can reinforce the negative stories that we may not really realize it, but that builds the kind of way in which we view the world. And we go home a little bit kind of confirming that the nonsense, the common sense we've been taught to believe is valid. And it's not always valid.
So if we don't go there, where do we go? I mean, what do we believe? And what have you then settled in? What is the truth for you? And specifically, what is the truth for you in the workplace? Because how will you earn money by believing in your truth?
Well, there are a lot of people who will pay for a voice that is, first of all, more considered. So I don't automatically preach answers. I don't preach a solution. I don't preach 3 steps to this, 8 keys to that, 4 agreements to this. Because I suddenly woke up one day in a Woolworths queue and I listened to myself, not just other people. And I couldn't believe the level of crap that we talk. We will gather in mobs and form an intellectual lowest common denominator, and we will cling to narratives that I now understand. Humans, if you look at the work of Yuval Harari, for example, on what's called intersubjective realities, we believe stories into reality. And there's beautiful evidence of this all over the world. We will find things on social media that we will then say things like, I've done my research. You have not done your research. Having a child doesn't make you an expert on parenting. It's a simple biological action that if you do certain things, you can become a parent. That does not qualify you to become an expert on things like psychology, medicine, social science. So I went to learn. And what I've learned is that I'm completely unsure, and that's okay. And that the best I can hope for is to navigate things that are never quite certain. And if I move towards, as an educator, if I move towards certainty, I must be careful because I'm dropping my obligation to learning by telling people what to think instead of asking them what they think, which is what I think we need to do more of.
So when we're in this world of learning, right, and I'm thinking specifically the workplace, we all want to show up clever, right? But we are showing up so scared. Why are we so terrified? Why are we so, what's this bunger? Like, why are we so scared?
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful question. I think we are getting more afraid because what we don't recognize is that we're living in a time where we are constantly sold the idea of false connection. And by that, I mean social networks. When I was born, as a forming child, I was able to meet my immediate family first, quite intensely. Then I was able to meet my extended family as I was introduced to the world. Then I started to form friendships and other social groupings. And the beautiful consequence of that was that, right or wrong, I was able to compare myself by degrees to the world. Now people are instantly compared, not only with the whole world immediately, but there is this pandemic of lying online about what I look like, how much I earn, how happy I am, how wholesome I am, what a wonderful human being I am. And so what happens is now it's this impossible comparison that people are born into, where your insecure self, which is your most private self, is being compared to the external projections of other insecure people. And that deep, deep impossibility of comparison creates incredible anxiety, because you will never match up.
You'll never meet up to their expectation or to what they present themselves as.
No, but what we don't take responsibility for is every time I alter an image of myself artificially, I am contributing to that impossible average being recalculated by an algorithm.
But why not do it, John? Because everyone is doing it.
Well, that's my mum might have said to me, well, then why don't you jump in the fire? Because your friends are jumping in the fire. Like we're losing our compass, our personal compass. We are struggling to, and I just want to say on that, so if you develop an external locus of control psychologically, so the outside world controls how you act and feel, that's a problem. The other problem, which we don't really talk about, is if you develop an overly internalized locus of control. So in other words, if only I have a say, that's also a problem, because I lose connection to the world. So what I'm learning in life, possibly my leaving comedy has got to do with this, is I didn't know this at the time, but finding a middle ground, which is probably why I've gravitated to Buddhism in the second half of my life, is because Buddhism teaches a beautiful idea called the middle way. And somewhere between me and the world, there's this middle place, which is probably better. And so fast judgment, criticism, blame, most retaliatory, adversarial ways of analyzing the world become less useful to me. And then I found education, because if I'm going to be in the Woolworths queue and I have a voice and democracy says it's got to be given a space, I would like to put some substance in that voice, because not only does education teach me what research really means, which very few people actually do, it's long and it's hard and it's difficult and it takes time and it takes investment, and reading 3 websites isn't really a way to do it. You can't do research on Instagram. But not only that, I'm also taught in an academic way to consider what I'm proposing and critique that before I present it, to show its limitations as part of my presenting this new idea. So what I now do with people is I don't want to tell them that they're wrong or fight them in the Woolworths queue. What I'd like to do is listen and try and form some space in which to consider that that person is, like you said, also afraid, also insecure, also trying their best, and try to contribute in a way that doesn't polarize people. Because in polarity, we go back to being our very stupidest. That's where we're really not thinking much, because our identity is challenged. And when your identity is challenged, there's scientific proof that we kind of galvanized back. And in South Africa, it just happens that in all the research that's been done, the strongest identity you will go back to in times of stress automatically is your racial grouping. And that's dangerous, because even those are fragmented. So identity of white or identity of black or identity of colored is not necessarily an accurate grouping. It's being formed in broad general categories. So returning to that isn't even a safe place, because you're not sure what it means anymore. No,
there's so much in there. I'm going to give a scenario. So I'm at work and I see my colleagues' life on social media, and I feel deeply connected to them because I know them. I know where they are. I get to see who they spend their weekends with. I mean, even I get it in the workplace. On a Monday morning when I get back to work, people say, hey, I saw that you took the kids out on Saturday, and on Sunday, you stayed home. And I can tell that some of it, even though people think there's a connection with me, that it is actually, and I learned this word from you, it's dislocated, because it's not the whole truth. And the same, the other day, the weirdest thing happened to me. So I go to a charity event and, you know, I'm arriving, I'm ready to like help the little children and some of my friends that live in this home. So every year I visit them and they're all very excited to see me, and I arrive there. And one of the senior people there, she's also really happy to see me, and I meet her for the very first time. And I say, hey, how are you doing? And she says, oh, no, I know how you're doing. And I say, oh, you do? Okay, so how am I? And she said, well, I saw that you traveled, you know. And I said to her, well, that's not all accurate. And she says, and to see where you're going to be later, I'll just look on Instagram. John, I was so shocked. I thought I'd bring it to this conversation where my intention wasn't to create a world for her but she feels deeply connected to me because of what she sees online and on social media. We have never been more certain that we are so, I mean, I'm John's friend because I know him, you know. I mean, I've known you for what, like 25 years of my life, but yet I don't know you. So I can't claim that I know everything about you or that I can tell you now, I haven't told anyone the story of you leaving comedy because I would rather let you relearn and tell me the story every single time because it might have changed for you. You know?
Yeah, that's changed.
And it's not my permission to tell the story. And therefore, I didn't even read your biography because it's outdated. You know? So why are we so certain that we connected to people, yet we so dislocated?
Yeah. Well, that's a beautiful question because the phrase dislocation is what, for me, causes the anxiety. It's what we think kind of is versus what really is. So let's call it outside if it was a graph. I don't know how to do this on your camera, but let's say this is the world as I really feel, and this is the world as it appears. It's this gap that's anxiety because we are one place, one time creatures. We've got to be in one place in one time. So that's why I'm a huge fan of stillness, of meditation, of starting off where I am, acknowledging where I am. You know, I do get angry. I do get jealous. I do get insecure. I do get, and it's in the admission of that. It's, you know, we're always taught in meditation, don't try and still your mind immediately. That's not the idea. The idea is to honor where you are, begin where you are. You start the journey with, I'm feeling less than, I'm feeling wronged, I'm feeling perhaps covetous or envious, or give it a name, honor it and own it. And then from there, we begin that friendship with self. And then we move into the place of stillness. So I agree with you. And I think we're presenting the world with one reality on one hand, and it's driven by fear. Generally, I'm not enough. I'm not enough. I'm not enough. Like that person is more. I've been left behind. I'm missing out. It's always a deficit. Even self-improvement, this absolute disease of self-improvement that's all over the world, you know, books and websites and podcasts. And every time you tell yourself you need self-improvement, what you are telling yourself is that you are not good enough. And there's a fundamental marketing in that, because if you're not afraid, you won't buy something that someone is selling. So this idea of self-improvement is frowned upon in some of the places where I spend time, because you can't begin a friendship with yourself on the premise that you aren't good enough to be a friend with yet. When I get there, when I get to my goal weight, when I get that education, when I get that clothing size, when I get that, when I win that race, when I, so what you're really saying is I am not friendship material for myself now. I have to get there and earn it. And unfortunately, we don't understand. If I feel that as a 51-year-old man, I don't understand how that is for an 8-year-old girl, a 5-year-old boy. Because
as you were saying it, I was thinking that, John, I was thinking of our children, and I'm going to ask you shortly about you and your daughter. You know, the other day, and I'm staying with the workplace, the other day I saw something interesting. More and more of my colleagues or acquaintances, they're posting videos of themselves becoming fit, and it's almost like they're becoming happier. And I'm like, but weren't you happy when you were not fit? You know, like we all desiring to become more fit. And you just said it, like the self-improvement idea of I will not be happy in my family, in my marriage, in my relationship, no matter what I have, unless I am a certain size or fit into my pant or have more Botox, you know, or look at my before and look at my after. Ooh, my after is much more satisfying, you know, like I don't want to teach that to anyone in the workplace. And I definitely don't want to teach it to my daughters, you know, but is there something that keeps us insecure? Like why? Wait, before you answer that, another nugget that I thought of, you get me very excited about your education. I had a chat with one of my consultants and we talked about that notion of not being enough. And more recently in the workplace, I lost a job. I lost one of my projects and walked under the bridge. And in it, we were talking about how as humans, we can be enough for, let's say, for God or your creator, or I could be enough for you and John could be for me. You know, we're enough for each other, but there's not just one enough. You know, I can be enough for other scenarios and people as well. So based on all of that, I mean, is it social media? What's keeping us so insecure? Why are we feeling not adequate? Why are we not feeling enough?
Well, I think, so first of all, it's that constant comparison. I think algorithms are designed to keep us insecure and keep showing us things. So we'll keep either watching a screen or buying something, consuming. There's lots and lots of research to show that algorithms have been found guilty of even feeding children who express some kind of connection to food-related eating disorders, feeding them content to keep them sick. There's writing on how the free market wants people constantly to be wanting stuff. And the way to do that is to sell either fear or insecurity. So there's that. There are more of us on the planet. There are trends that change. There are ways that the media portrays people that change. So there are lots and lots of things. But what I mostly find is what I'm going to call escapism. You know, we've taught escapism as this kind of noble, wonderful idea. We go to the movies to escape. We go here to escape. But the truth is we've kind of wrapped that into something a bit more insidious, which is this need to escape all the time. The best thing I can be is here now. That is the absolute pinnacle of achievement for my child, for my partner, for myself. It doesn't matter. You know, I have to be here now. You spoke about those things when I get there, So what happens is I'm so busy trying to get to the future where I don't belong. It's not built for that. It's not possible that I am ignoring the things right in front of me. And that's when you wake up 10 years later and go, what have I achieved? Or because the truth is time is enough if I'm in it. Time is more than enough if I'm here now, you know? So it's like, well, do I need a Stanley cup or am I able to appreciate a sunbeam, you know, like on the carpet?
I have a Stanley cup. Okay.
Yeah, me too. I'm not perfect. But you see, we lose our locus of control and we blame it on the world. But the truth is we have the capability to pull that locus of control closer to ourselves. The danger is we mustn't pull it too close in, because then it's all about me. So it's partially about the world. And, you know, I heard this beautiful phrase about successful practice that can make you a friend of yourself and the world at the same time. Now, if you can, for me, that's my only mission now, is to be a friend of myself and the world. Like, I love that phrase. And I think it's worth aiming for. By being present.
I like the notion of being the time now is important. More recently, I started doing an exercise where I'm just sitting with my kids, you know, or I'm just sitting with myself. And I mean, no state of meditation. I didn't give myself time and now I will do 10 minutes of meditation. Like, there is no expectancy. I am just quiet with myself, like I am with you drinking my tea, you know. And it's fascinating what you find when you're sitting next to even your kids and when you're quiet. They actually just appreciate you being there and being quiet. You don't have to ask them about the day. It doesn't have to be time. And now it's time for timetables. It doesn't have to be this big announcement of, and I'm by no means a Buddhist or anywhere near that. So I want to ask you based on that. I mean, what has stillness taught you? If we are at work and it's busy and we are able to do some breathing next to our kids or by ourselves, even if it's 5 minutes, what has stillness come to teach you, John?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm by no means an accomplished Buddhist practitioner. I am very new to this. I'm really loving finding a belief system that works for me. And I'm in the early stages of understanding what that means. What it has brought me actually is the capacity to appreciate other people's belief systems, which I really love, because I also realize that it doesn't matter what you do. If it works for you, that is wonderful. If it helps you to be a friend of the world, I don't mind how you get there, but I love anything which gives people a framework on which to, some anchors, basically. So that's good. What it's brought me is, most of all, and in a word, I suppose, space. Because just as you were talking, I was thinking, like, I used to get home sometimes very angry from work, like tired. And it was almost my job to let my family know how tired I was. And just nothing gave me that right, you know, like that's my choices in life that got me to that end of the day. And it's almost like this need to pay it forward, and there's no need. So space. What it does for me is, if I can become still, I can observe those things. So tiredness, irritation, a sense of injustice. That's often one that comes up, is I do all this and then, you know, what do I get back? And then the guy in the traffic, he didn't, you know.
Yeah.
So what it does is it builds me space to understand that the other person in the traffic has had pretty much the same day as trying to get home too. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of people in the traffic have had a much tougher day than me actually. And so I don't have to add to the, like, the mess. I can actually take something out of the mess by giving somebody a smile, or just going, when they cut me off in traffic and they look up and they, the start of a conflict, just give them a smile and go, oh, you know what, like, it's cool, man. We're all trying to get home. So suddenly there's this better energy and nothing's changed. He still cut me off. And there's a rule and it says you can't cut people off. And like, we, you know, but I just made a decision, and it's from understanding the value of stillness in the world. And the fact that if I can let that person go, I might get home in a better state, or my loved ones, or the people I care about, because something good came out of something potentially bad. And it's the ability to observe and not react. So I think Viktor Frankl said it beautifully in that book, Man's Search for Meaning. If I can learn to put space between the stimulus and the reaction, it doesn't have to be a reaction. It can be a response, something considered. And then someone else said something beautiful the other day, which was, it's in that gap, in that pause, that reflection, that's kind of God's spot. It's the higher consciousness that lives in that gap. It doesn't need to react right now. And I think I read a Buddhist thing that said, you know, we share a lot of things in common with animals. Like we have to hunt and we have to protect. We have to kind of look after our basic needs. Like, we are capable of so much more. What a tragedy if we spent a human life only rising to the level of animals who've got limited capacity, and we've got all this extra space to do stuff. So for me, taking the time to find stillness, and I don't always get it right, but when I do, it just gives me some space in which to make better choices and get perspective. I'm not the result of social media. No one is. That's the truth. Taking time off social media, which sounds like an impossibility for some people, is this wonderful holiday from false approval, which helps me. I don't go on nearly as much as I used to.
I take that break every December, and I must tell you, I don't miss it at all. I spend a month with my kids and I don't know what's happening in current affairs, because my current situation is my husband and my mom and my dad and my mother-in-law, my father-in-law. I love them dearly, and my children. So look, I'm 44 and you're 51. And in our working careers and in our lives, there were many things that developed John Flissmus. There's many things that made me Ilana. And both of us have worked really hard to be ourselves, not celebrities, to be ourselves. Like John, the anonymous John, has also worked really hard to become who he is. And sometimes he might not be happy about who he is. And Sari, who's listening to this podcast, has also worked really hard in who she wants to become. And things have happened.
Yeah.
Like, I realized recently that your dad died. I'm sorry, long life, you know, and
thanks.
And like in my life, the one thing that started my business again was also a death. You know, I fled Cape Town. You know when you still find water in the kettle 6 months later, like it was that kind of situation, you know, that drove me out of my house back to Joburg with my kids. And I just left with my husband and the kids. And we started again. We didn't start over. We continued the journey. We started again in Joburg. And we, thank God, live in both cities. But if there are younger people listening to this podcast, you know, that hasn't gone through all the things, trauma, realizations, study, knowledge. At the moment, they have social media and they have their books and they have their colleagues and they have, we have our church and we have the homes and we have our work colleagues around us, you know. What kind of questions do we ask ourselves when there is that anxiety and the battle for presence to reclaim stillness in a world of distraction? How do we keep asking questions to get to our earthly heaven while we are still here?
Yeah, I mean, I think a question I always ask people is, if you did nothing today, what are you worth? And if you do nothing, what are you worth? Get to that answer, because the truth is, true value doesn't shift on an hourly or daily basis. It cannot. It's impossible. You know, and it's all perception, which is back to Yuval Harari's work, which is so important, because as apes, we generally will tell each other stories and that will turn sentiment And sentiment actually changes very important things like financial value. It changes political outcomes. It changes all kinds of massive decisions for humanity. So that's a very good question. Is if I, one of my, my therapist actually says, don't just do something, sit there. And that's a beautiful mantra. Don't just do something, sit there, because often action is an attempt to control. And whether it's control perception of myself or it's to control the outcome for other people, or, you know, it's a very interesting thing. Often action is taught. You've got to take action. Now you do. But you know, I will say, if your back office isn't in good shape, your front office action is not going to be good either. So for example, let's take you and I, right? So my back office was not in good shape. I can only speak for myself. So my output ended up in a bit of a train smash for me. I think from watching what you've done with Alana is you've used what you have to create useful content, useful dialogue, useful information. It's a different thing. And we can talk about celebrity or not celebrity. I mean, that doesn't matter. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to be well known. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Mm. The Buddhists say, you don't have to change a thing about your lifestyle to become a Buddhist at all. You can be successful, you can be wealthy. The only thing you have to change is the object of your cherishing. It must go from being yourself to all others. And that's a wonderful way to put it, because some people have abundance and they create something positive. Other people get abundance and create negativity. And the same goes with having nothing. You can have a deficit. You can make something good out of that, or you can make something terrible. So it's almost the same thing. So for me, it's just being conscious. It's asking myself, am I awake in the moment? Am I here right now? You know, my value doesn't change based on commentary or something that is trivial and surface level. I have the ability to distort reality a million ways. Now, I have that choice though. And so for me, the question is always, am I aware of my choice? Because it never goes away. Viktor Frankl said, nobody can take your personal freedom. Only you can give it away. And he said it, if you know the story of Viktor Frankl's life, that you know, he was being tortured in by Nazis in a death camp, genetic experiments and stuff. And he developed compassion for his torturers because he started to see them as humans, even in all that inhumanity. Now, most of us are taught that you can't do that. There's something wrong with you if you forgive people at that level. Well, no. I mean, he went through it and he decided it was possible. And I've never been through anything that bad. So it must be possible for me to reframe reality in a better way.
What's the best thing that you've ever done as a working father?
I'm not sure what the working part implies.
Wait, you have to give context. How old is your baby now?
My child is 23 years old, and she was living with me until about 6 months ago, from the age of about 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. So we're very much a team. And the two things I did, which I'm really happy about. So when my kid was small, when her name is Uma, when Uma was small, I was used to call her Princess. So one day she said, Dad, why do you call me Princess? Because we don't live in a castle. So I was like, that's true. So at that stage, the Kailani Castle was a hotel. So I booked us a room at the Kailani Castle one day after school. I said, come, we're going to a castle. That's the one. That was fun. She doesn't even remember it these days. But the other one was, she told me she wanted to be an animator. So I said, okay, well then, I think we should phone the best animation school in the world and let's go and visit them. We went, it's in Paris. It's one of the best in the world. And it's a school that feeds talent into Pixar. So we went there and we spent a week, just the two of us in Paris, and he's a very artistic child. So we rented, and I love art. So we spent a week walking around galleries in Paris. Mm. And at the end of the week, she had her meeting with the school, you know. And I just said to her, I said, look, we've come all the way. We're going to this thing. But if you decide that you don't want to do this, please understand. I don't mind. Like, we've had a wonderful time. It's been amazing. You know, showing your child like famous paintings for the first time, famous sculptures and whatever. And I just said to her, like, we've had a great time. And we left there and she didn't want to be an animator, but we had a really cool time. So those are two things. And I know sounds a bit materialistic because it involves, you know, going somewhere and spending money. But, you know, memories. It's something so special about those memories. So I would say those are two things. And the other one is when she called me in, she studied psychology and she ended up calling me one day from, she was studying out of town and she said, "Dad, I think I want to come home." And I said, "Well, okay." It was a year and a bit into her degree. And I said, "Okay, well, why do you want to come home? Like, what's going on?" And she said, "Well, first of all, I'm not doing very well and I'm struggling with some mental stuff." And I said, "Okay. And how do you feel about psychology?" She said, I think I've been studying this for you." And then I said, "Well, come home immediately. Come home straight away. Please don't do this anymore. Come home, take a year, figure out what you want to do, what excites you, and then let's see if you can do that." And that's what we did. And I'm really chuffed that we did that because she was struggling and it wasn't for her. And I remember the pride of being a dad whose kid wants to leave university and give up. And I realized that I don't care what other people think. I needed my child home and just come home and let me see you and let me just check you out and see what's going on. And then we can talk about, like, we'll make another plan. But I didn't care about what other people think. And I don't mind telling that story because it makes no difference to me. I think she's found her passion and I couldn't be more excited for her.
But she was safe and she had you. Like, my dad's my best friend. Okay. If he told me to come home, I would come home without a doubt. You know, we actually just need someone to care. And you did that. So thank you for telling the story. I really appreciate it. Is there anything you want to ask me on Mind at Work?
Yeah. How do you handle it when you are not having a great time and then you've got to present like the stuff that helps people?
So when I'm not having a great time is usually not in the moment. It's usually when I go home and when I overthink. I think my bubble is so designed in such a way that it is almost bulletproof. I live in a world that I enjoy and that I like, and I don't mind bad behavior from people because I empathize with them.
Yeah.
I said the silliest thing the other day to one of my colleagues. I said to him, "I even love the racist." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because the racist is predictable." You know, it's easier to understand than the person that has behavior that I don't know what's coming next.
Mm.
And I am an overthinker. I'll go home and I'll think about the day. And I'll sometimes wonder if I asked the right questions. Did I present myself in the right way? Did I say hi loud enough? Did I smile enough to make that person feel that they belong?
Mm.
But I think learning over the years have made my environment fairly bulletproof. And I only really let people in if I know that they're going to help me. So thanks for asking me a question.
Yeah, a good question. It's a good answer. I never thought about that, you know. It's design as well. You've designed it around you, which is quite a good way to be. So you have, I'm hoping that you, what I got, and I hope I got it right, but it's almost like the way which you've designed this thing perhaps it's a little more supportive of you as well.
Mm.
Would that make sense?
It does make sense because, you know what, John, how we show up at work or anyway, you know, especially if you're a giver. My love language is to see people's reaction when I give you something, whether it's a gift or a smile or a hug or advice. But the minute people didn't ask for it, right? You are letting people into your environment and you give them an opportunity to comment or be part of something and to be part of you. Mm. And because I have so many jobs, okay, so when most people have a 9-to-5 and you have a certain persona, I have many jobs in a day and I have different bosses and I have different people that I report to or that I hang out with. And I have decided that depending on where I show up, this is how much I can let them in because that is my way of protecting myself so that I am able to go home and be that good mom for my kids or go home happy or sit in the car and not break down. I think I used to. I don't remember the last time I broke down in car. But it's because there's many, many opinions and commentaries that I just don't take seriously.
Yeah. But it's a huge superpower to be.
Thank you.
That you, if you self-reflect, for me, if I self-reflect and I'm honest about my own flaws, and they're many, like I'm not in any way trying to preach that I'm not got this Dang. Way. I don't, I fail all the time and it's really important. Yeah. It's how I've learned to fail. That's really key, is to sit with, wow, that wasn't very brave, or wow, that wasn't very like ideal, or that wasn't like, because what we were talking about earlier, it's in sitting with my spiritual cellulite. Mm-hmm. If I sit with that, and I understand that comes with a package, because it's, you know, I do a lot of work in body image sometimes, and you know, love handles are part of me that is lovable. It's like, that's part of the package. There's a gentleness to me that's not aiming for this like angular, you know, lean, absolutely no margin for error. Yeah. Yeah. That's a very uncaring version of me. Mm. It's not able to contain. Whereas when I'm a little softer, I'm a little bit more at home with myself. I maybe have more capacity to reflect. And it's like what you just said, you know, you're aware of things maybe more. So those breakdowns happen less because it's not necessary to get to that point of extremity. Mm. We don't work so hard, so we don't have to break down so hard. Sometimes you can work and then rest when you can, because you express that you need a rest. You express that you're not doing okay, and the exhaustion of pretending is not so intense. So for me, it's like this. That's why it's interesting to say, people say like, why the change? There's no change. It's just an unfolding.
Development.
It's an unfolding. Yeah, it's leaning into gentleness. It's leaning into honesty. And vulnerability is not a hardcore place. It's a gentle place. I don't see this thing of like spiritual warrior, because now we're talking about aggression again. Mm. And I don't like that. I think it's sitting on a cushion and it's being a little bit soft and gentle and choosing non-aggression. And I just want to mention, one of my teachers said, you know, when you're meditating and you find your mind drifting, please ask yourself gently to come back. Don't shout.
Mm.
And I love that, because it's a betrayal of the middle way to use aggro to get back on track. Yeah. And so there's this, we don't appreciate gentleness. We don't appreciate non-aggression. Everything's a war. Every sports brand, like you watch people at war with themselves trying to win a race.
Yeah. Fast.
All they're
going to
win is one photograph. Yeah. You spend your life sacrificing life to get to that one photograph, that snapshot of you winning. So you've not been present in your life getting to that point. Then it will tell you how amazing you are. And then you spend the rest of your life never being able to get back to that photograph. So the point of that photograph is it's robbed you of life. And so you don't need a snapshot, because you're in it. It's unfolding. It's beautiful. You know, making a cup of tea, playing with a dog, phoning your mom, losing a gig. You know, and not managing to impress someone, so that you're able to sit with that insecurity and go, wow, I'm in the presence of this very uncomfortable teacher, but let me stay with it and see where this goes, because now I have a chance to show courage. Now I've got a chance to show patience, and I've got a chance to show compassion. If I'm doing well, all I'm saying is I don't need those things. Whereas if I'm doing a bit of both, you know, when I'm with a kid, I've made so many mistakes as a parent, and then I've made some wins, like I've done some good things. But both of them have taught me how to be more present with my child today. And it's, we mustn't learn or teach children even to value triumphs and be absolutely terrified of losing, because not how we live, not real, you know.
John Flismus, it's really good getting to know you.
Thank you. Thank you.